ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why do humans hold on to stuff? Oddments we don't use, and yet can't quite throw out. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? I'm Annabelle Crabb. Come and have a rummage through the story of us told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf here at the Sydney Writers' Festival. I'm Cassie McCullough.
And I'm Kate Evans, delighted to be here with a live audience on Gadigal land, where we acknowledge the traditional storytellers of this place.
And we also have a superstar from ABC Radio National joining us, Claire Nichols from The Book Show. She's lurking in the audience. Hello!
Hello!
We'll explain what she's doing in just a moment.
Mm-hmm. And here too we have a collection of writers and a big agenda. But let's meet our guests first. Tony Burch is with us, poet, novelist, professor of Australian literature at the University of Melbourne. His books include The White Girl and Pictures of You. Also, Siang Lu, writer and creator of Silly Bookstagram. His novel Ghost Cities won the latest Miles Franklin Literary Award. And our international guest, Lily King, American novelist and short story writer, whose books include Writers and Lovers and her latest, Heart the Lover. Hello, hello.
Now, also on our agenda, we are here to officially launch the theme for this year's Top 100 Books Countdown on ABC Radio National. Now, you remember we did this last year, Kate. You remember that?
Yes, and last year we asked you, dear readers, to vote for your favourite books of the 21st century. That was the last 25 years only from anywhere in the world.
Now, I was going to make a little kind of guessing game about what the theme was going to be, you know, books written off planet. There's probably one, I don't know, but look, it's very straightforward, but it's so exciting. It is the best Australian book of all time.
We are talking this year 19th century mysteries and 1930s experimental modernism. Realist novels from the 40s and science fiction from the 1990s, 1980s grunge and arguments about architecture and design from 1960. So do start thinking.
Now, it isn't easy once you sit down to try to do this. It's actually a bit of a challenge, and there's no right or wrong, of course, but we thought we might ask for a few suggestions from our guests today. Now, Claire, maybe you are going to talk to some people or you're...
I am keeping an eye on the room, Kate and Cassie. So we have people in the audience who are already sending in their suggestions of their favourite Australian books ever. I'm seeing fiction and non-fiction coming in already. I'm also going to pick out a couple of people to tell me about some favourites. So I'll keep you posted.
And can I just ask, when you put in your suggestions for the books that you want to champion, include the author as well as the title, because, you know, we might just remember all the details, but in a little flurry on stage, we might not.
Well, why don't we get rolling and get some suggestions from our guests. Lily King, as an outsider to Australian literature, you're an American, what work of Australian fiction made an impact on you? Maybe, yeah, something memorable, a scene or something.
Maybe even something, the first Australian book you read.
Well, the very first one was The Thorn Birds by Colleen McCullough. I was 15. My mother had just remarried. I finally got the canopy bed that I always wanted that she had, but then when she remarried, it was too small. And I have such vivid memories of lying in that bed for like an entire weekend, just devouring the Thornbirds. I loved that book. I thought it was the sexiest, sexiest book. And now when I think of it, it is about a priest who falls in love with a four-year-old child. I mean, they don't do anything until she's about 17 or 18. But I thought, you know, it was just so beautiful, that sense of destiny. And of course, they're star-crossed lovers, and they can't ever really be together, but the attraction is just like palpable. And I try not to think about her being four and then eight and then 12. But it was just, for a 15-year-old girl, it was enthralling.
And of course, the television miniseries was a sensation as well. And by chance, introduced two of the people who became one of our greatest love stories of all time, and that being Rachel Ward and Brian Brown, who were in those roles. So
Colleen McCullough's The Thornbirds was published in 1977 and was an enormous bestseller. And so, Tony Burch, popular fiction is such an important part of this story. But sometimes popular novels, or, you know, works that are extraordinarily popular, sort of fade from view and don't really enter the canon, but still have a big impact on people. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a book from your childhood home.
Well, we only had one book in our childhood home, so it's easy to talk about and easy to remember. So my parents both worked in factories, and we grew up reading comics. Comics don't make it into the 100 list, I don't think. But my mother had a copy of a book called A Bunch of Ratbags, by a writer using the pseudonym of William Dick, which is odd that you didn't have to choose that name, why you would. But and that was an interesting book because, although its literary merits would be questionable, my parents loved the book because it was a book set in Melbourne's working class Footscray in the western suburbs. It was a book set in the 1950s, and it was basically about bodgy and widgy culture coming into that rock and roll era. So it's just before Bill Haley and the Comets movie Rock Around the Clock hits Australia. And my parents loved the book because they recognised themselves in it, because they were those sort of teenagers in the early 50s. And so my mother passed the book on to me, and I read a lot as a kid. I was a really avid reader. So I remember reading the book at quite a young age, and like my parents, being struck about, this is a book about Melbourne. So there are scenes in the book where the protagonist gets a job in Myer in a department store, and I knew the city. So it was the first time, and probably the only time for a long time, that I read a book which was about my city. And I suppose in similar reference to thinking about the book in a contemporary sense, there are no four-year-old girls who preach fall in love with. But today, if you read it, I think there are elements of racism in the book that are problematic towards new arrivals, particularly Italian immigrants. I think the book is in some ways homophobic in the way it portrays a window dresser in Myer. But accepting that, I still think it's a really important book where people who are not recognised as book readers, or people who are not part of a literary culture, recognise themselves in work that they love. My parents, my mum in particular, just loved the book.
And we would love to hear about books that nobody knows about. Introduce us to new books and go, hang on, why don't we reread that?
So A Bunch of Ratbags by, do you remember who it was by?
Yeah, William Dick.
William Dick, sorry, yeah, of course.
How could you forget that, Claire?
Blocked it out. What about you, Siang Lu, Miles Franklin Literary Award winner? What would you like to recommend?
A couple. When sort of got in touch to ask about this, I sort of had a panic attack in thinking about...
Sorry.
Are there enough? Do I know enough? And, of course, surely... sure enough, there were. I'm part of a group of writers in Brisbane, really close-knit, who catch up at the pub every so often, every month or so, and we call ourselves the Shorts Club, and we read a short story. But it's really just an excuse to get together and have a drink, really. But quite recently, one of our group had picked Nam Lee's The Boat, and I hadn't read it in so many years. But it really struck me how our books, you know, mine, Ghost Cities and The Boat, were sort of unknowingly in conversation with each other in a lot of ways that I'm still to unpack. But I think that that opening story is just so lush and metafictional. There's a character in that story whose name is Nam, and you're sort of invited to consider whether or not this is Nam Lee. And part of it, it's actually a small part of this story, but it's the one that resonated most with me, was just the most perfect distillation of what it is to be a child of the diaspora. So this character's father comes to visit him at the Iowa workshop where he's trying to write a collection of short stories. And his father, quite like my father, is sort of trying to find ways to be proud of the son he doesn't quite understand. There's this bit of dialogue where the Nam character says there's an art museum across the river. And the father says, "Ah, take me there." And the son replies, "The museum?" And the father says, "No, the river." And as soon as I read that, I realized that would exactly be the type of conversation I would have with my father, which is not to say that he's artless, but rather that there is a cultural disconnect. And I think the first-gen migrants coming to Australia trying to figure out a way to live and survive are not necessarily thinking about how they're going to educate their children in what it means to be Australian.
Wow, that's beautiful.
What a lovely selection we've got already, and that also point to the different ways of reading and remembering books and the resonances that they have. Now, this is ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. We're launching the Top 100 Australian Books Countdown for 2026. Now, voting will open on the last day of August, and by then we will have a collection of 1,000 books ready to go, ready for you to vote for your own top 10. All will be revealed finally in mid-October. But Claire Nichols from Radio National's The Book Show, are suggestions already coming in? What's happening?
They are coming in thick and fast. And this is a room of people with very good taste, Kate. We're seeing lots of awesome books come through. So keep those votes coming. A cool thing about this little voting system we have in the room is you can upvote and downvote certain titles. So we're seeing a real appetite for coming-of-age books. A lot of votes for Looking for Alibrandi by Melina Marchetta. What a wonderful novel for so many people. Another coming-of-age book I noticed on the list, Limber Lost by Robbie Arnott, one of my personal favourites. And Jackie, who's right next to me, has voted for another kind of coming-of-age novel, My Brilliant Career, by Stella Miles Franklin. When did you read this, Jackie?
About 2 months ago, after seeing the stage musical. I was inspired to read the actual book.
And what did you make of it?
I really enjoyed it. I found that it was a book a little bit ahead of its time in terms of the trying to break those gender stereotypes in the time that it was set.
Yeah. So it's fantastic to see these coming-of-age novels coming from all across Australian literary history. Lots more coming, so I'll keep you guys posted.
Wow, and perhaps I might shout out another book that could be understood as a coming-of-age novel, and that's Tony Jordan's Tenderfoot, which has just been revealed to be on the long list for the Miles Franklin Literary Award. And why do I say this? I might have just seen her in the audience here today at the Sydney Writers' Festival.
Woo-hoo!
But but Cassie McCullough, as we like to say, opinions, we've had a few, the two of us. So what book would you like to add to the mix? What would you like to champion?
Look, I actually did this in the last countdown. I put Peter Temple number one with his book Broken Shore. But I did that because I decided the list was going to have half Australian, half whatever else I wanted to add. So that was a strategic choice I made. And then I just wanted to remind people that the Outback Noir wasn't invented in the last 10 years. It's been around for quite some time. And also it's just a great, you know, spunky, broken-hearted, crushed man story, which I like. But I think I'm entertaining. The first one that comes to my mind, I share with our audience member, whose name I've suddenly, sorry, forgotten. What's your name again?
Jackie.
Yeah, that I share with Jackie is My Brilliant Career. I too just recently read it in the last few years, and it is so fresh and so shocking and so relevant and contemporary. And she is a rat bag. I mean, I love that film of Gillian, I was going to say Gillian Anderson, Gillian Armstrong's film from the late 70s. It's beautiful, but that's a very different young woman to the one I met in the book. And I think it still has things that are edgy to say now about choices people make. So I want to throw my hat in the ring as well as Jackie for My Brilliant Career. If you haven't read it, give it a go. And if you can't read it, because it is quite wordy, being an early book, it was published in 1901, you can try it on an audiobook, because that might help you as well. But just on that point, Kate, of it being published in 1901, it wasn't published in Australia. It was published in Scotland, in Edinburgh. And this is one of the things that we've had to negotiate with the discussions around setting an Australian book for the countdown, all these little details. What if it wasn't published in Australia? Does that count? If it wasn't by an Australian author, but it's entirely about Australia, does that count? So we've kind of landed on it being very, very open, I think. So we don't exclude, for example, No Friend But the Mountains by Baruz Puchami, you know, the detainee on Manus Island. So, if you're thinking, would this fit in? Let's just see, what do you think an Australian book is?
And perhaps I might offer up my...
Yes, sorry. I got on my high horse there.
Can I make... Look, I always find making these decisions, making my shortlist, it kills me. I find it very hard, and I'm going to change my list. I've been tossing up Ethel Turner's Seven Little Australians from 1894, which I read as a child, Peter Carey's Illiwacka from 1985, which I loved, or one of Peter Corriss's Cliff Hardy novels as a way to read your way into Sydney. But I really can't resist Florence James and Dimphna Cusack's Come In Spinner. Now, that was written for a competition in 1946. It wasn't published until 1951. Its first print run was 100,000 copies, which I think any Australian writer in the room would be gobsmacked about. But the reason there was a delay in the publishing was because it was so audacious. It was so shocking. It was a story set in World War II, based around a hotel, the lives of three women who worked in the Marie Antoinette beauty parlour. But it's about working class lives. It's about Australia and Sydney when the American soldiers came. It's a story about abortion, prostitution. It's full of vernacular and these vivid voices. And it challenges a lot of the sort of lazy expectations people might have about what a book published in 1951 is. It's an absolute ripper of a read. It's a chunky novel. I didn't read it until the 1990s. And yes, I did read it because there was a TV series out at the same time. I was rereading it yesterday and I remembered so many scenes from it. I loved that. Another update from you, Claire Nichols. What are people talking about in the room?
There is a big appetite for fiction in the room. Right at the top of the voting right now is The Book Thief by Marcus Suzak. Uh-huh. That, of course, came out second in our top books of the 21st century vote last year. What an absolute gem of a book. Looking for Alibrandi, going strong. We also have Oscar and Lucinda by Peter Carey.
Love that.
Of course, Boy Swallows Universe. And, of course, Cloud Street, someone's written here, by the master Tim Winton. As a proud West Australian, I'm going to back that one up, gang.
Yeah, I think he'll appear a few times in the list. Now, I guess let's hear a little bit more from our guests and what else they might like to add to this list of this pile of books. Lily King, when we first asked you to think about Australian books and writers that were important to you, there was one writer that was at the top mm-hmm. of the list. Who and why?
Shirley Hazard. I love the response. The Evening of the Holiday and Transit of Venus, I guess those are the two that I would push for. They're such entirely different books. The Evening of the Holiday is like this very slim, I don't want to say prose poem because that might put some people off, but it's just so beautifully written. It's a love story. She is just a master of the sentence. And of the detail, there's a bracelet. There's there's an ice cream cone, and at the very end there are a pair of gloves that is, and she just, I know this doesn't make it sound, it is just a brilliant book about a big love that can't really happen in a very small amount of pages. But then Transit of Venus is this big saga about two sisters who come from Australia with their terrible kind of older cousin, and who's just Dora, who's supposed to take care of them. Is she an aunt, maybe? She's kind of maybe a younger aunt. She's just a little bit older than they are. And it's so beautifully structurally. It's almost like a small, there's mysteries tucked in that you don't even know that you're getting. And again, the sentences, sentence by sentence, just glorious.
Well, and The Transit of Venus, published in 1980, one of those books that rewards very close reading.
Yeah.
I mean, there are clues in the first couple of pages that are resolved at the end.
Exactly.
But the first time you read it, you go, hang on, what did I miss? And you have to go back and think about what this extraordinary work of fiction is doing.
It's a real puzzle.
But I guess, Lily, so there we're talking about a real top shelf pick. So Tony Birch, what Australian books do you think absolutely have to be in there somewhere when we're thinking about our top 100 Australian books?
And are you suggesting I'm on the bottom shelf? I'm going,
not for a moment. And in fact, you have to be voting for Tony Birch's books, of course.
Well, I'll just mention very quickly. I mean, coming to Sydney, I always think of Roof Park. Mm. Sydney is one of the most beautifully photographed cities in sort of social realism photography, and I love photographs. And often when I look at historical images of urban Sydney, I'll think of Roof Park's work. Poor Man's Orange, obviously, but her body of work. Quickly mention another novel that will be little known is Wildcat Falling, published by Colin Johnson in 1965, who became the writer Mudvarur. But that book is remarkable for looking at, again, youth culture, beatnik culture in Perth in the 60s. And as a man of colour writing that book, there is this metaphor that lurks in the book of the always Aboriginal people existing in the shadows of society. So that's important. But for me, I think Power Without Glory by Frank Hardy is probably one of the most important books I've ever read. We've talked about this before about, you know, Hardy addresses the sort of issue of his character, John West, who's based on the Melbourne SP bookmaker, entrepreneur, poor man made rich, John Wren. And the interesting thing in the book, the tension is between the author and the readers, that, you know, Frank Hardy's a committed communist. The book is a really strong critique of capitalism, and this man who grew up very poor, working class, who ends up living in the mansion on the hill, literally in Studley Park above Collingwood. So it's a very strong critical reading of John Wren. The point here being that everyone, again, that I knew that read it, my parents and their generation, they loved the book for a very different reason. One is it was their turf. Collingwood and Fitzroy was their turf. And the great contradiction is whereas Hardy's critical of poor man makes good, when I was a kid, you know, your parents would walk you through Collingwood, up Johnson Street, up the hill, look at that grand mansion and say, I want to live here. So everyone admired Wren for the fact that he'd become very rich. He was a great benefactor of the community. And also the sites in that book, literally the locations. You could go around with the book in hand and visit the SP bookmaking shop, visit the church. So again, it was locations that people understood. It made the book real for them. In other words, although it's a work of fiction, it's a place that they were invested in with their own story. So, and it is a very important book politically, in that it looks at issues like the important referendum campaigns of 1916, where Archbishop Daniel Mannix was opposed to the referendum, conscription of Australian troops in the First World War, and that tension between Mannix and other figures in the trade unions, in the Labor Party, etc. So it is a very important book about what you might call Victorian politics as well.
And so political fiction, political books, works of history, but also championing a book that takes you into your place. That's also something that you might want to think about as across this year as we're talking about the top 100 books.
Yeah, that's a really powerful element, isn't it, when you read something that it explains to you something you thought you knew so well. What about you, Siang? I mean, there is a bit of pressure around these nominations, isn't there?
So much. I think also I really resonate with the book that takes you to your place, and for me the place is failure. And I just think so much and so often of Michael Winkler's Grimish, which was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin. I was thinking about him recently because I had just read his second novel, Grief Dog, which is brilliant in so many ways and hilarious and deep and really heartfelt and empathetic. But the book for me is really always Grimish, and it's because, and I won't sort of explain what all the book is about, but there is a narrator in it that is perhaps Michael himself. If you wouldn't mind, I might do a bit of a reading.
Oh, that'd be great.
Just a quick one. And just to set the stage, this narrator is, he's 16 years old. He's competing in the high school's open age 400 meter race. And in really beautiful prose, the narrator describes the conditions of the country race and this especially ferocious wind that blows the contestants almost backwards while they're running, which turns the race actually not into one of speed, but a test of strength and the willingness to endure, and especially endure pain. And he actually describes winning the race. That's a spoiler alert. And he only just wins it by one single stride. And the narrator, I won't say Michael, but the narrator of the book, the fictional narrator, he could really, I think, have left us right there in that moment of victory, but instead comes out with an admission that really breaks my heart. And so this is the beginning of the excerpt. And then, with the line almost reached, I gave up. I was so close, but the pain won. I submitted and walked the last step or two over the line, except that the runner on my right must have given up a moment before I did. I was the winner, district school's open champion. It qualified me to travel to the city to compete in the state championships, but I had seen the winning times for that age group in previous years and knew that I would not get within kui of anyone at that level, even in a typhoon. I had my one moment ever of sporting glory, and yet I know, even if no one else does, that I gave in before the line, broke, surrendered to the pain. I also remember, although no one else would, that my physical reaction after the race was so intense that I had to withdraw from anchoring the 4x100 meter relay and let my team down. I also know how shamefully proud I was of coming first in that regional race, a sin made sillier by the knowledge that on a still day, I would never have won.
Oh, and that's from Michael Winkler's Grimish, read and championed for us by Siyoung Liu here on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf as we are launching the theme for this year's Top 100 Books Countdown. But, you know, Claire Nichols, you read an awful lot of fiction for The Book Show, but are there other types of books that you think have shaped us as a nation, books that you'd want to champion?
Okay, this is a left field choice, Kate, but I think the most important book in my house growing up was, in fact, the Australian Women's Weekly birthday cake book.
Yeah.
That is a book that we spent hours with turning the pages. You could spend months choosing the cake of your dreams. I'd like to say that I actually made the pool cake 2 weeks ago and it was very successful, so the book is still going strong. Thank you.
Claire, I think you need to explain the Australian Women's Weekly cake book for Lily King.
Yes, well, Lily, it is a book where you take just a kind of basic cake and you decorate it in a wild and wacky way. You can make a duck, which is now famous internationally thanks to Bluey. You can make the train, the hardest cake in the world. And in fact, there's one that I think is structurally impossible. The author has come back and said the tip truck was never actually possible. So don't try that one. But I have had tips from friends of you can achieve almost anything with enough kebab sticks and butter icing. But there is a lot of non-fiction books that are really important, and those are emerging in the room as people are sending in their picks. My Place by Sally Morgan, a beautiful autobiography. Tell Me Why by Archie Roach. Working Class Boy by Jimmy Barnes. a lot of Helen Garner, a lot of fantastic Helen Garner. So it's really important to keep in mind when choosing your favourite Australian book. I think in this room we're a lot of fiction lovers, and I think fiction's going to go strong, but there's a lot of other things we can pull on as well when we're putting together our personal lists.
You mentioned Sally Morgan's My Place. In terms of the development of Aboriginal fiction in Australia, Tony, how important was that book?
It's a major book. I mean, just to give a bit of context, I was my first tutoring job at Melbourne University was probably 1992, 93, and we were running a course on Aboriginal literature, and it was very hard to get a 12-week list together of published work. Obviously, there's a lot of Aboriginal writing that was never published. So it was hard to get enough material. And I think Sally Morgan's book, and then followed, I think, remarkably by Ruby Langford's Don't Take Your Love to Town. These were books that were so foundational because I think for a younger generation of Aboriginal writers coming through, they really, yeah, there are only a couple of sort of role models, you know, Ujuru, of course, Cap Walker, but not many. And I think Sally Morgan's book, you know, it's a very popular book. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies, and I think there was some criticism of Sally Morgan at the time, which I think was terribly misplaced, and in fact nothing more than bullying, because that book amongst Aboriginal people was really championed. I think it encouraged a lot of people to write, and I think this, just for a broader context of this now, of course, if I was running a course on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander literature, I could put, yeah, five courses together. There's so much stuff coming out, so many emerging writers, which is absolutely fantastic. But just to bring this home, I do a lot of work with schools, and I do a lot of visits with school students and Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal kids. For a young Aboriginal kid in high school to be talking to a person who is a published writer and is also an Aboriginal person, it is remarkably energetic. So that mentor role in our community is absolutely vital. So in that way, you could think of why books are important, you know, for various reasons. And I think, you know, talking whether it be nonfiction for us in the audience, I'm sure that there are books that have been really important and influential on all of us, which may not be the best sells, which may not have won the literary prizes, because there is something of great emotional resonance in the book that encourages us to do the things we want to do.
And I misspoke.
Yeah. Hear, hear.
And, of course, Sally Morgan's My Place is memoir, as is Ruby Langford Guinevere's Don't Take Your Love to Town. And you might well have memoirs that you want to add to this list as well.
It's interesting, even just in this discussion, there are themes emerging already, and I think this is what's going to happen as we start this conversation about books. Already we know some of the famous themes of Australian literature and non-fiction. Poverty seems to come up in every decade. Also, the lost child, which was famously the subject of much discussion back in the late 80s, early 90s, that these books about children who've been taken by the land somehow were very resonant. Even Dot and the Kangaroo, but you know, Picnic at Hanging Rock, Walkabout, this idea that the land could steal your precious future somehow in books. But Kate, you were talking about, what was the one in the hotel?
Come in Spinner.
That made me think, there's so many Australian books set in hotels, and the hotel as a site of drama and action, you know, Caddyshack and you know, many others. So, you know, this is what I think is going to be exciting about the whole project.
And so, Lily King, give us something else on your list, Australian books that have made an impact on you.
I was thinking about The Idea of Perfection by Kate Grenville. I read that many years ago, and I still, again, just remember the feeling of how much I loved that book. It's about, I mean, I'm sure you all know, it's about a man who comes to a small town. You're going to have to help me about what the town is called. It begins with a K and it's very long.
And it is a fictional town. That makes it harder for us to remember.
Okay. It sounds very authentically Australian.
Putting us on the spot.
And he's come to demolish a bridge, and this other the other protagonist has come to establish, he's a kind of a curator and a very good crafter and quilter, and she's come to establish a museum of Aboriginal arts and crafts. And it's a love story. But they're very, very unlikely lovers. I mean, it's kind of the last thing they came to do in their lives is fall in love. And it's very, very funny. And I highly, highly recommend it. I mean, of course, I also just need to make a plug in case I don't get the mic again for The Children's Bach by Helen Garner. I think is just an extraordinary book as well.
Are there any fans of that book here? Yes.
Actually, can I ask a quick follow-up question, Lily King? You mentioned that the idea of perfection is a love story. And I heard you speak a few days ago here at the Sydney Writers' Festival about your own book, Heart the Lover, and you made the case for a love story being a political act, particularly right now.
Yes, I mean, it was in the context of a larger talk about my government and my vile and cruel and deadly administration right now and how I had tried to write a political murder mystery kind of directly speaking to the first Trump administration. And then instead, I just had to make a huge pivot and write a love story. And then now we're in the second Trump administration, and it does feel like a radical act. It feels like to write about love is to write about our best emotions of our humanity and our best selves, and that's the kind of self that a tyrant wants to destroy. And I think it's really important to understand that Trump is very laughable, but he is a real tyrant.
Thank you. Siyang Liu, Peter Carey has been mentioned more than once, and I mentioned Illiwacker as one of my favourites, as well as Oscar and Lucinda, but I know that he is a writer who you champion as well. Which book and why?
True History of the Kelly Gang. And I think it probably contains my favourite line in all of Australian fiction. So just to set the scene, it's very early in the book and a policeman comes to visit young Ned Kelly. And in the conversation between the policeman and Ned Kelly's mother, sort of comes up a salacious rumour about the boy's father, which the boy is very curious about, but his mother refuses to explain. And young Ned Kelly obsesses over it. And that quote is, he then goes on, "The memory of the policeman's words lay inside me like the egg of a liver fluke. And while I went about my growing up, this slander wormed deeper and deeper into my heart and there grew fat." Just the rhythm of that final "and there grew fat." You can almost feel the musicality to it.
Tony, you wanted to respond to the liver fluke.
Well, I actually I wanted to respond mentioning Peter Carey, actually, because I know that it may not be likely that short story collections will get much of a Guernsey or a hearing, but thinking about Carey, again, when I started teaching his short stories, one of my favourite stories of all time, American Dreams, another story, Crabs, they're remarkable works of short fiction in collections. And again, very influential amongst, you know, short story writers. We're a sort of a subculture and a cult, and we pass around these books. And those two stories by Carey, any Australian writer who's been working in the short form for long enough, they'll go back to those stories, amongst others, some early Tim Winton short stories, which people often forget about him being a short story writer. They are seminal works for people who want to enjoy and improve their craft as short fiction writers.
I think if I had to nominate my favourite work by Peter Carey, it would be The Fat Man in History, because I remember reading it and having my hair just blowing back, going, wow, this is weird.
A brilliant book.
Yeah, great.
This is The Bookshelf on ABC Radio National with me, Kate Evans, with Cassie McCullough, and with our guests Lily King, Tony Birch and Siyang Liu, and of course our special guest Claire Nichols from The Book Show, who is reading the temperature of the room.
What's happening? And can I tell you, Kate and Cassie, that Diane here next to me has wearing top 100 merch in the room. She's wearing her top 100 books T-shirt.
Oh, can you stand up for us, Diane?
Ta-da! And Diane, you are a big Richard Flanagan fan. What books are you considering?
Oh, look, I'm torn between two. I loved The Narrow Road to the Deep North, but his memoir, Question 7, was just, I cried through both of them. And it was a little bit like Cassie said earlier, sometimes you think you know a lot about something. And I had no idea that Australian prisoners of war ended up in Japan. It was just a revelation to me, but beautiful, both beautiful books. And I just, yeah, I adore his writing.
And so important to read together, those books, I believe. Let me tell you about some other books that are coming up in the room. The Dry by Jane Harper, what an important work of crime fiction here in Australia. Ladies in Black by Madeleine St. James. Playing Beatty Bow by Ruth Park. Chai Time at Cinnamon Gardens by fellow Miles Franklin winner Shankari Chandran. Praise by Andrew McGann. Yes, Cassie's throwing her arms in the air.
I've already got three on my top 10 preliminary.
Yeah.
That you've just, yeah.
And I do have to say, guys, that we are also seeing votes come in for Ghost Cities by Siang Lu and The White Girl by Tony Birch.
And this is the thing. We want to be both reminded of books that we already know and love and also of those we'd forgotten about, you know, poetry, history. A.B. Facey's A Fortunate Life, which I know is one of my he didn't read many books, but that was one that he loved. And what about, I don't know, Norman Lindsay's The Magic Pudding?
Oh, yeah. Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie.
Oh, yeah. Didn't you go dressed up as Snugglepot or Cuddle Pie?
I did.
A fancy dress thing? This is what
God,
we know about each other.
Never tell Kate anything because she doesn't forget. That's right. I went and I split a palm leaf pie, a big one, in down the middle and wrapped it around myself. And I had a beret on.
It was just last year.
That was just going to work. No. Okay, look, I just feel like we're starting to have this conversation and it's making me realise how exciting it is going to be having it with the nation over the coming months and all the voting and all the discussions and, you know, the sort of details of it. Where do you want to go from here, Kate?
I'd really like to just keep sinking into place. I mean, because Siang, we have you on the stage as a writer from Brisbane and, of course, recently we've all been thinking about David Malouf, the late David Malouf, because he died so recently and he wrote his way into Brisbane. Are there other stories of Brisbane that you want us to remember or think about?
Putting me on the spot here because
yes,
I was thinking
spot,
all
sorry.
About Melbourne, actually.
Oh, okay. Tell us your favourite Melbourne novel then.
Well, I don't think it's going to be an unpopular pick, but Helen Garner's Monkey Grip was just so revelatory. I was having a conversation with a fellow author about what it means to be a classic book. Like, what does that, what are the terms of, you know, requirements of becoming a classic? And we couldn't quite agree, but there was one thing that we did agree on, which was that this book that we think is a classic must sire other books. Like, it must be inspirational enough for other books to have been of the tradition. And I just read a friend's book that is, I think, coming out soon. And it is very much of the tradition of Helen Garner's Monkey Grip, which sort of gave me the thought to go back and reread it. And it is so fresh. And it is so, like, it's unbelievable that it was written so long ago because it could have been published today. And I think that's probably the mark of a great work of fiction.
And Lily King, I think you have read Monkey Grip too.
Yes. I just read it last summer. Extraordinary. I mean, it's just an extraordinary experience, completely immersive. I honestly feel like I lived it and I didn't read it.
And this was also a book that got a sort of muted critical reception from a number of male reviewers in particular who said, haven't you just published your diary? And of course, Helen Garner famously has just published her diaries and they are the most extraordinary pieces of writing. And so it was a bit of a grower as a book, as it resonated with more and more people. I think it was 1977 that Monkey Grip was written. So I'll do a quick pivot and put Claire Nichols on the spot.
Well, I am a proud West Australian, so I wanted to call out a few wonderful West Australian authors that I would love to see championed on this list. Kim Scott, of course, one of the great writers of the West Australian landscape, and, of course, our very own Tim Winton, who's doing very well in the poll here. I'd also like to call out a book called Extinctions by Josephine Wilson, which won the Miles Franklin some years ago. It is a book, and as a West Australian, when you open that, you can feel the sun beating down on you. You can hear that air conditioner whirring. I've never had such a kind of transportative experience in picking up a book and feeling like I'm reading my home. But let me tell you, Kate and Cassie, what's happening in the room. We have a very strong top five emerging.
Oh, wow.
The Book Thief, right there at the top. Cloud Street by the master Tim Winton. Looking for Ella Brundy. Oscar and Lucinda by Peter Carey. Boy Swallows Universe by Trent Dalton. And I'm going to throw in number six as well because it's a relatively new book, but it has had an incredible life already. And that is Wild Dark Shore by Charlotte McConaughey. That book.
Yeah.
My husband has not read a book in 10 years and I gave that to him and he read it in a week. Fantastic read.
I just saw a woman on the bus on my way home reading it like this.
Mm. You can't put it down.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad that you also mentioned Kim Scott and Benang and That Dead Man Dance is just extraordinary writing. And I will mention that in the Writers on Writers series from Black Ink, I know that Tony has written about Kim Scott. Look, there's so many books that we could talk about. The works of Frank Moorhouse, Eleanor Dark's The Timeless Land, Thea Astley's Reaching Tin River is actually one of my favourites. Siang Lu, would you like to throw another on the pile?
Stoneyard Devotional by Charlotte Wood. I think it is sometimes possible for a debut writer to write a quite excellent book, but only a masterful writer can write a masterful book, and this one is that. And it's sort of the new frontier for me. You know, I'm always reading and trying to learn from other writers, and the things that Charlotte does with silence and white space in this book are really profound. And it's actually terrifying as a like at a craft level to figure out how to do more with less.
And I guess one of the other things that talking about that book does is it takes us out of the cities and into regional Australia because this character goes to find her moment of silence. Cassie's already mentioned that, of course, regional noir and crime fiction, there's been a lot of it written. You know, there are always secrets in country towns if you hadn't noticed that.
And murderers. Strange.
But then the bush, the landscape itself as a threatening moment. I mean, Wake in Fright, Tony.
Yeah, so Wake in Fright by Kenneth Cook is another remarkable book. I am very disappointed that every book I mention, I haven't had one ooh or ah from the audience. So
quick, give us an ooh or an ah for Wake in Fright.
Can I just mention, ooh. Yeah, that's better. Thank you. Don't overdo it. Come on. So Kenneth Cook's Wake in Fright, I had to do for a school text. So it was one of those books that's forced upon you as a kid. And when you're in school and your books are forced upon you, you tend not to read them. So I didn't pay it enough attention. And then I think I saw the film version, which is quite scary. I went back to the book. The book was a remarkable book. I think it's one of those things that often when people remember Wake in Fright, they actually remember the kangaroo shoot from the film. It's so visceral. But I think it's a genuinely frightening book. And you make the point, you know, this book is set in regional Australia in a country town. The sort of the male culture of alcoholism and drinking and misogyny, homophobia, it's all there. You know, what a great country we live in. It's all there, but I recognise those male characters as I did in those same male people in my life in the inner city. So what's interesting here, although there's so many elements of landscape in that book that affect the behaviour of people, the behaviour of drunken men in that book, they could have been men in my own home or in my own street. So there was, again, a familiarity. And it's a book also that's had a really strong impact overseas because I know there's a conference coming up later in the year where that book about Australian Gothic will be part of the program. So it is a very influential book. And for me, I would sort of put it on my top 10. I'm going to throw one in there quickly before I get bummed out. And this is not going to get a ooh or ah, so don't fake it, right? No. the Melbourne poet Pio, his book 24 Hours, I think is the greatest work of poetry written in Australia. It's a massive, chunky book of about 600 pages. And what it does, it's all based inside an espresso bar in Fitzroy or in Brunswick Street, and I've never read a book which captures the voice, the theatricality, the drama, and the pathos and the nuance of growing up in that suburb at the time. And every time I read a section from that book, I'm just mesmerised by Pio's ability to capture, like talk about sound, to capture both sound and silence. It's a remarkable book.
And I can see, Lily, you're responding to, is it to the poetry?
No, it's not. I'm sorry. I see the time is running, and I just wanted to mention Christina Stead's The Man Who Loved Children. I mean, I feel like we can't. I can't have a discussion about. I think it's just, I mean, I read it when I was young. It was one of my first sort of Australian experiences. And yet it's set in DC. And I think she did that for, I don't know if it was her publisher.
I believe it was the publisher's. I think it was 1940, The Man Who Loved Children. Mm. And it was first written in Australia, and then she was put under pressure to relocate it. And so does it feel, even though it is set in Washington, D.C., does it feel like an Australian voice to you read it?
Yes. I mean, it felt like a complete disconnect. I didn't understand how these particular people with this particular vernacular could be in Washington, D.C. It made no sense to me. But I still loved the book, and the house is so absorbing that you're not really thinking about the setting. But I would love to get my hands on an early version of that book that's set in Australia, because I think that's where it could be even better.
Jonathan Franzen champions that book in an essay of his.
I think, how they sent those golden records out into space on one of those spaceships that had recorded all of humanity's brilliant work. I think somewhere in space there is an ongoing conversation about that book, about Christina Stead and The Man Who Loved Children. I feel like I've been hearing it for many, many decades.
The dialogue is just extraordinary. I mean, it's just an extraordinary book. It's unlike anything else.
It's on the list.
Shall we get a very quick final update from you, Claire Nichols?
Absolutely. Thanks to everyone for doing a little vote in the room today. Of course, we have the big vote to come. But the top 10 books we have seen come in from the audience today: Seven Little Australians, Burial Rites, The Spare Room by Helen Garner, The Dry by Jane Harper, Wild Dark Shore by Charlotte McConaghy, Boy Swallows Universe by Trent Dalton, Oscar and Lucinda by Peter Carey, Cloud Street by the master Tim Winton, Looking for Ella Brandy, and at number one in the room today, The Book Thief by Marcus Suzak.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, you're going to have so many chances to think about this and to talk about it. Think, be strategic, come up with a list, talk about it. Don't put the usual ones on, resurrect some old ones, go decade by decade, but do vote and tell people about it. And really, thanks all for coming. It's been so fantastic to have you here.
So we've been The Bookshelf. Thanks to our guests.
Oh, thank you.
See you all again next time. Okay, here we are backstage, just come off stage. We are in a little dressing room as we reflect on what just happened as we launched the top 100 Australian books.
Well, I think that went quite well. What do you think, Kate?
I reckon there's a lot of books that people are starting to think about. We're building up our lists and we're getting a bit excited for the top 100 books countdown 2026.
Claire Nichols, are you excited?
I'm very excited. We've got to tell people when the voting is going to start.
Details.
Yeah. Voting's going to begin on the last day of August. It's going to run for 5 weeks, so you're going to be able to nominate 10 of your favourite books. Send them in to us between that last day of August and on the 17th and 18th of October, we are going to announce the results live on the radio, Kate Evans.
But before that, if people are thinking, well, hang on, how on earth am I going to narrow down my 10? How am I even going to remember what to vote for? We will have a list of 1,000 books. And if the book you want to vote for isn't there, you can, of course, add your own. I will be putting mine in on the very last day of voting. So the 1st of October will be the day that I put in my final 10. And then on the 17th and 18th of October is when we will find out what those top 100 Australian books are.
Well, we can keep thinking. We've got until the 31st of August to put our votes in. So time to get to work.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.